You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 4th of May 2013 on Monocle 24.
A magazine for the mindful farmer and reading tips from the editor of the design biannual Desenio. The subscription copies are in their envelopes for edition 36 of The Stack. Also coming up over the next hour, we're joined by the editor of Gym Class magazine.
I would describe Gym Class as a quality fanzine about magazines with interviews with leading magazine makers.
Plus, we're reunited with a former Monocle editor who's created a modern take on agricultural publishing.
You know, over years, I realized, well, this isn't just my next story. This is actually a cultural movement. This is something happening, and I want to lead this conversation.
All that and a few magazine reviews on edition 36 of The Stack, right here on Monocle 24. Hello, good morning, and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House and our weekly session on all that's wonderful in the world of journals, deluxe tabloids, pocket-sized print, and just plain old magazines. Having been on the road for a few weeks with stops in Hong Kong, Tokyo, Toronto, and more, I'm happy to report that if you look in the right places, the business of selling periodicals is in rude health. Of course, it's not the same story for the big boys who continue to cut their print offer in favor of more space for cans of 7-Up. But perhaps it was ever thus. Anyway, we have plenty to get through over the next 50 minutes or so, so let's meet our guests. Now, our first guest joining us around the table is Johanna Agerman-Ross, the editor-in-chief of the London-based design journal Desenio. Before Johanna founded Desenio, she was the deputy editor of Icon magazine. Of course, many of you will be familiar with that design title, and also lectured at the Royal College of Art. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Now, of course, I've been seeing the title all over the world, and I'm always amazed when people bring out, particularly we know how hard it is to get on newsstands, to get into bookshops, but yet you've managed to do that with a very handsome title, or pretty title, but I'd say more handsome, if that's fair.
That's good. Thank you.
Tell me, I guess, two things. Where did you see the gap in the market? I mean, coming from a title like Icon, which, of course, has had a very firm position, certainly within the UK marketplace. What did you see as the opportunity?
Well, I think the market lacked a biannual design journal. I think, as you said, a handsome one. I think Icon coming out on a monthly basis, the focus was to turn around news quickly and feel like we were really competing with online to be newsworthy. So for me, Desenio is a way of making a well-researched, in-depth design magazine, which also focuses on fashion and architecture, and making sure that we spend time to make it qualitative, interesting, in-depth, and a real treat for the reader. And I think that sometimes lacks in some current design magazines and design titles that come out more frequently.
Mm. Who do you see as your audience? I mean, when you think about that reader, and when you're sitting down to draw up the story list for the magazine, sit down and commission, and then, of course, edit and design it, who are you thinking of? And are you thinking along, just, let's say, psychographically, or are you also really thinking, across borders as well?
Definitely across borders. The international angle of the magazine is very important for me. Being Swedish, living in London and travelling constantly, just like you, I feel it's important not to feel too national or too UK-based. That's one of the reasons why the title is international rather than an English-sounding name. I'm also very aware that the reader isn't necessarily an expert on design and architecture, but there are plenty of people out there that have a really, really big interest in the field without kind of necessarily working within design and architecture. And as a result, we're trying to communicate to people that have an interest, but not necessarily the knowledge that maybe someone from the architecture profession has, or someone who works as a product designer. Of course, we don't want to exclude those people either. So I know that we have a lot of keen readers from the professions. But for me, it's really important that it has a breadth that basically takes in a readership which, yeah, isn't just expert. So therefore, we try to have footnotes in the longer features in order to inform people a little bit more about the content in the features and making it accessible while not being stupid.
Mm. I'm also joined around the table by a gentleman who definitely shares our passion for the printed page, so much so that he started a magazine about magazines. His name is Stephen Gregor. He's from Melbourne, and the publication is called Gym Class Magazine. We'll talk about the title in a moment. Outside of that project, Stephen is also a freelance editorial designer for the likes of Vogue, GQ, and Wired. You get your paycheck from Condé Nast, quite clearly. Good morning and welcome.
Hey, Tyler. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good, good. Now, we have to start with addressing the name Gym Class, but for something which, of course, is chronicling all that's happening with periodicals.
Well, it started more with a broader content. So there was stuff in there that was, more just creative. Creative was the sort of what the content was all about. But, you know, magazines are my first love. And over time, it's just become a lot more magazine centric. So the title, Gym Class Magazine, came about because I started it because I wasn't really feeling any real connection with men's magazines. And I was that guy who was chosen last in high school gym class. So I called it Gym Class Magazine and it had the strap line for the guy chosen last. So it was an alternate men's magazine, I guess. Mm.
And was also maybe like a swipe at Men's Health as well?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Just a little. And in thinking about what the offer was, well, I guess first thing, tell us, I mean, how long have you been going with it? And then the evolution that moved you from, let's say, being a little bit more men's general interest to really, focusing your craft now on periodicals?
Well, I'm just working on issue 10 now. And it started as a quarterly thing, but the day job gets in the way. So it's now, twice a year, perhaps. It's an ad hoc publishing schedule. It is printed in hard copy and most recently also as an iPad app, because my day job is predominantly as a tablet designer. So I was interested in, exploring that avenue. Moving into magazines was the more I wrote about magazines, the more I spoke about people about to people about magazines was it just that's what I became interested in. So
I want to tell me how is your relationship, and maybe this is for both of you, but and this is something that comes up quite often on the program, and of course someone who's in the trade as well. I'm always keen to know what people's relationship is with magazines, and whether you have a triage approach when you buy things, because there are some things which I will consume immediately and then I distribute them to other people because I want to look at them, but then it's of more value to another colleague. There's one that might go, it only stays on the desk. It doesn't have the right of going into my bag to go home, and it'll be consumed at a later date. And then there's ones you don't even want to look at because you're so excited about seeing them. So given what you do, Stephen, I'm very keen to know that do you have a somewhat frustrated relationship with titles because you're covering them all the time?
I'm a crazy collector, so I will go into a store and I will go a little bit mental. And then I will go home with a bag full of magazines and I'll sit there for a bit and I'll eventually work my way through them. And because I am a collector, I find it very hard to throw them away, so I will give them away. So
we have to ask, and do you have lockup space for them? I mean, are you that much of a collector that there's, if we went out to the suburbs of London, that there is a storage space for them?
Well, my partner and I live in a very small flat in the Barbican, and we have some lovely shelving that they sit, they take part of the place.
It's creaking
on
right now.
And we do have some storage space underground underneath the Barbican.
Okay, then you're serious.
Has
you're
some
serious.
In there, yeah.
Johanna, what about you? I also want to talk to both of you about just maybe the luxury of being ad hoc or twice a year with the magazine as well. But your relationship with titles, how do you consume print?
Not as obsessive as that. And I'm very impressed whenever I hear people being that dedicated to magazines. I mean, I definitely thrive on looking at magazines and love to look at them, but I'm quite a cautious consumer. I'm not someone that goes into a store and buys everything. I tend to flick a lot and see what grabs me and maybe pick up one or two titles.
Is that competitive? Because I think there's always that aspect when you're an editor, you're always looking at magazines competitively. Okay, damn it, they did that. Okay, we're going to bin that idea. Or they did didn't do it very well, and you feel that here's something, and I guess this it maybe is a good seg into being a biannual. Do you sometimes see things and think, okay, you know, they had to get it in there first, but in the desire to get it in there first, it means they took press photos. They weren't able to, you know, really indulge that topic.
Of course, of course. I mean, it is difficult for me to look at magazines as a, you know, layperson. I need to look at it as an editor, and I do always compare what we do to other magazines, of course. I mean, for me, when I see other magazines covering stories that we are interested in, yes, I do always take the approach that what can we do different? What can we add to that story? Who can we commission to take the photograph to make it extra special, or who can we commission to write it? And then more than anything, I think that we dedicate space to stories. I think that being a biannual, and well, at the moment we're around 200 pages, we tend to have features that range from sort of 20 to 22 pages long. In the first issue we had a 30 page feature, and that's quite a luxury, especially when you're small and independent like we are. You don't really have a kind of publisher telling you that a certain percentage needs to be spent on advertising pages and so on, and we can be more creative in the way that we work with a magazine and from that point of view. So yeah, we always try to make stories our own, for sure, and always find our own angle on them.
Mm-hmm. I want to hear about frequency. Where's your cutoff point? I mean, because obviously, you know, we're all, you know, somehow in the in the news business a little bit as well. You know, when you're looking at your editorial schedule, is there a point when you sort of draw the line and you say, I really want to get this in? And is there a conflict between newsiness and just saying, no, I want something which is evergreen, and maybe that's how you draw up your story list? How does it work?
We try to be newsworthy despite being biannual, because I think sometimes it can be difficult to be newsworthy coming out just twice a year, but our kind of concept is that we cover news from the last 6 months, news that we think is worthwhile to include in a biannual. So things that we feel have shaped the world around us over the last 6 months. And so that can, I mean, at the moment we're working on issue 4, due out in September. We have already plotted more or less, you know, the stories for that issue, but there will always be things coming up last minute. I mean, for issue 4, which is currently out, you know, I did an interview 1 week before going to print, and you know, so sometimes you have to be quite flexible with when those cutoff points are.
And what about with the more ad hoc, the luxury of an ad hoc schedule as well? And maybe sort of, you know, take us through, you know, and you know, of course, for people who aren't familiar with the title, you know, what are the topics that you're jumping into with Gym Class?
Well, you know, Gym Class isn't a business venture for me. It's basically a hobby. So I don't really stress the publishing schedule all that much. But the content is the content that I include in Gym Class magazine is newsworthy at the time. So as soon as I finish an issue, I'm thinking about the next one, and I'll probably spend a couple of months collating some stories, organizing the interviews, and then, you know, another couple of months putting the thing together. So by the time it comes out, you know, maybe it's not breaking news, but it's still something that is ongoing. And, you know, the art directors and creative directors that I talk to quite often talk about how what they're going to be doing in the next 6 months and what have you. So stuff is still relevant.
Steve, when you look at the sector right now, and you talk about also, you know, wanting to be, you know, also, you know, newsworthy, and you want to be relevant. Otherwise, you know, why are we all doing what we do every month? What stands out for you when you look at the state of the market right now? I mean, as you said, you know, here you've started celebrating magazines, but then now, of course, you're doing a tablet edition as well. What are, let's say, the points of either sort of, you know, friction, delight for you when you look at the market right now?
Well, like I said, you know, my day job is working as a tablet designer, so that's something that I'm really quite focused on at the moment, and you know, it's still it's so early in the process of it. And I've heard you talk on previous episodes of this program how, you know, financially it's such a interesting area. You know, where are the publishers?
I don't think I use the word interesting when I talk about it, anyway.
And, you know, there are a lot of publishers that are working away knowing that, you know, it's not all that financially viable at the moment, but hopefully in 5 years' time it will be.
Right.
I read an article in New York Magazine just recently about the New York Times and newspapers and how newspapers are struggling at the moment. And you know, what is the future for newspapers in that, you know, if they close and they say, okay, we're going to do something digitally, there's not the money from ad revenue to support what they were doing in print. So, you know, the level, the quality of journalism, the quality of product that readers are used to in print is just not going to be possible digitally.
No.
So that is something that I'm particularly interested in at the moment. Mm. And something that I think is worth keeping an eye on. I'm holding out for the Monocle tablet edition. But
are you? You must be holding out for a long time. it's a fascinating topic, one that we always come back to. But, you know, we were just having a discussion in this very building yesterday. It's, and, you know, I just came back from, it's always interesting, I think, to go around the world anew and visiting different markets. And, you know, we see that, you know, not every region of the world is pulling at the same speed. In many ways, I think, you know, the U.S. is, or maybe North America, sort of jumped headlong into this and are trying to figure it out and really trying to post-rationalize, you know, what do they do with this? Now, you know, trying to figure out the business model on, you know, on the fly. You go to Japan, and Japan is, you know, is a very, you know, cautious, very risk-averse culture. And you can see in the Japanese market that, you know, they really want to plot it out. I mean, no matter what happens, you get into a taxi in Japan, the driver always wants to know where he's going first, rather than, again, trying to figure it out as they go. And I think the media market is, you know, reflects that as well. There's this real ethos of saying, do we really want to know where are we going to be in 36 months, 48 months, if we venture down this road. And so, I think many have accused, you know, not just the Japanese market. I think people have pointed fingers at the Germans. Oh, these people are so incredibly slow. Why aren't they on it? But I think, as we've said, maybe it is the role of the New York Times and big people to, you know, be the guinea pigs, the Newhouse family. They have the pockets, the deep pockets, to maybe venture into this territory. But I think for smaller publishers, it's quite difficult. Hence, we're sitting in a radio studio. But
well, I think it's really interesting that the big publishers, some of the big publishers are really, you know, pushing ahead with this. I think that's something to be commended, and I think there's something for really. I think there's you know, quite a lot of possibility there for really small publishers. I think maybe it's the medium publishers that maybe should hold off and just see what happens for a while.
Mm. We're going to just take a very, very short break. When we come back, though, we're going to listen to a very small piece. And when you talk about sort of small publishers and you know, where they can go, it's a very fine example. You're listening to The Stack. We're in London. Short break. Back in a moment.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of markets, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
And you're back with The Stack here on a Saturday morning in London on Monocle 24. I'm with Stephen Greger, the founder of Gym Class magazine. That's supposed to be his what he's moonlighting with, but also working, of course, in the design area with a variety of Condé Nast titles. And also Johanna Agerman-Ross, editor-in-chief of the design title, the biannual Diseño. Listeners, if you could have heard what we were talking about during the break just now, it's fascinating. Maybe we'll give you a snippet a little bit later. But before that, we're going to head across the Atlantic because our next story takes us to the second floor of a creaky turn-of-the-century townhouse in Hudson, New York, the new home to Modern, Farmer magazine founded by a former Monocle editor, also contributing editor, Anne-Marie Gardner. Modern Farmer is far more than a predictable take on backyard chickens and DIY agriculture. Rather, Gardner's new quarterly takes stock of the stories behind the food we eat, from invasive pigs in suburban Berlin to organic farming trends in rural China. We sent our Barrett Austin on the train to talk to Anne-Marie Gardner.
Up here in the country, I'm having, my neighbors are farmers, and I would be having these conversations about food and people wanting chickens. But what I was so surprised to learn in my travels for Monocle is that wherever I'd go, whether it was Iceland or the remote end of Alaska, or they once put me on a mail boat in South Africa and I went to St. Helena, the island in the middle of the Atlantic, people were having the exact same conversations that they were having here in the country. And, you know, over years, I realized, well, this isn't just my next story. This is actually a cultural movement. This is something happening, and I want to lead this conversation.
If we could talk maybe a little bit about where you go in the first issue of Modern Farmer.
Sure.
What are some of the stories that are told in this first issue?
Okay, so we go to China, and we go to an organic farm in China that has been growing because of the food security issues. And it's a response to that, and it's really interesting to know that there is this organic farming movement in China. We go to Malawi for mangoes. We go to Mississippi to a wild pig conference. And we go to Michigan, and we go to the first LEED certified dairy barn. It's the local and the global.
Who do you see as being the audience for this magazine? Because in a sense, it's sort of very niche focused on the issue of farming and on the issue of food. Is it something that's just for people who already have an interest in those topics, or is it something that really has something to say to everyone?
Well, what's so exciting about Modern Farmer is I was always calling it sort of the first media brand that puts the culture into agriculture. So it's where agriculture meets pop culture. And I really believe that the audience for Modern Farmer is anybody who cares about where their food comes from. So this could be somebody that maybe is mildly interested in growing food, so maybe they grow basil on their windowsill in Williamsburg, or they are a third generation farmer. So I think we really run the gamut of interest.
And what about as far as distribution goes? You're based here in Hudson, New York, mm-hmm. about 2 hours outside of New York City. Very interesting place to run a magazine, but where's the magazine going to be sold?
I love the idea that we can run a global media company from Hudson, and that was my plan because I didn't want to move back to New York City. So we were expecting to start with newsstands. So we're selling about 55,000 magazines on newsstand right now. And we're selling at Tractor Supply Company. We're selling at Whole Foods. We're in 200 Hudson News. We are in Barnes and Nobles and a lot of independent bookstores. So we had to tell them no, because we didn't want to sell to only newsstand. But we also have a strategy to be selling through these organic delivery services. So CSAs are community supported agriculture. So these small farmers have created collectives around the country and in England. For example, Riverford Organic delivers to 40,000 customers, people that want locally grown food and they want to know their farmer. So one of our really kind of unique distribution strategies, we have about 30 to 40,000 magazines going out through these CSA delivery services. And Peter Sham Nurseries in London are going to be the first international distribution for us. We've had requests in London, but we wanted to sort of get our base here. And then I think our next round two, we're really going to focus on distributing in London and probably look more globally, you know, for issue two.
Looking at the magazine, you know, it has almost sort of a trade element to it, but it's something that reaches out and connects with people who don't farm. But how have the farmers responded to this magazine? What's the response from people who are actually active in sort of the farming business?
Every industry probably wants to be celebrated, right? So you can't really be against us because we're so for farmers, and there's enough information in the course of the magazine, so I think we cover very serious farming issues, and then we cover a how-to, probably for a more aspirational farmer, and in that section we get the advice of some of the larger farmers.
I'm curious about the reception that Modern Farmer has gotten so far. What are people saying when you sort of explain it to them, what you're doing? People who see the magazine for the first time,
Well, what was interesting is when people were hearing about us launching and they were hearing we were coming, they automatically went to Hipster Food Magazine, right? Yeah. And I wasn't worried about that because our content delivers so much more than that. I mean, we're clearly not a hipster food magazine. So then when people get it, I think they're really surprised how beautiful it is to touch and hold, and they weren't expecting it. I think people are surprised that it's a global magazine done out of Hudson, because maybe they thought it was going to be like a local edibles kind of project.
Obviously, a lot of the stories that are going to be covered in this magazine will be US-based because the magazine is based here. But how important has it been thus far for Modern Farmer to really cast its net really wide and cover a whole range of stories across the world?
Actually, we probably have fewer US stories than international stories. So that's really important to me because I think, and certainly in some of the comments we're getting, what people are appreciating about our content is that we basically take the global and then we funnel it down to the local. And that has to be our perspective, and that's going to remain our perspective. So every US-based story we have is going to have a global component. I think it's important that people understand that agriculture, to put it in perspective, you can't operate individually, you know, you can't operate in a fishbowl. And then the fact that, you know, what happens to the weather in Australia could actually affect what you're eating. And we always want to make that point. How does the global affect the local, and how does the local affect the global?
The editorial content of the magazine runs this gamut between sort of very serious, almost activist journalism. And then there, you know, you find things that are sort of more quirky, things that are fun to read about. How do you balance the editorial content between the real sort of global stories, the hard-hitting agricultural stories, and, you know, things that are a little bit lighter?
Well, we're definitely not an activist publication. The serious content is really a result of conversations I've had around the world. So, for example, we did a story on humane farming. This came from my travels to Rome, to LA, to Finland. And at dinner conversations, you've probably are having these conversations too. People are all like, is this grass-free meat? Do you eat meat still? What does it mean? And really, I wanted to know what it meant. You know, what does this mean? What does humanely slaughtered mean? And I was really clear to make this story explanatory. We're not telling people how to live their lives at all. We're journalists and we want to tell the story. And so then for the fun stories, of course, it's the same. So, you know, we have a story about talking to the plants, and a lot of people love this. We have a story about preppers saving seeds. We love that. You know, it's just a great story, and we're not promoting this, but we're fascinated by it. And it's I think because we're more generalist journalists, we can tell these stories in a very objective way.
And that was our Barrett Austin talking to our Anne-Marie Gardner. I say our because she still is on our masthead, but a former editor here, about her magazine, Modern Farmer. And as you're saying, that piece going to be available through Petersham Nurseries, and I think we should probably be putting it on our own shelves at our Monocle shops as well. I wanted to just go back to you, Stephen. You were talking about just, you know, small-scale publishing. You're a small-scale publisher yourself. When, you know, on one side, you know, I guess Monday to Friday, you know, you're working for one of the world's biggest media companies, certainly one of the biggest players in international magazines. But then, you know, you have this other life where you're doing your own publishing as well. Are you excited by the state of the market? And just, you know, when I was looking through an old issue of yours, it's amazing that you can have a sit down, you know, with the likes of you know, Penny Martin, editor of The Gentlewoman, and Joop van Bennekom, you know, of course, of the same group, and have these discussions about, you know, let's say, you know, publishing, which, you know, some might call it niche or just maybe a little bit lower fi than what the big players are doing. An exciting time for where we are, not just because it's a time of rethink, but also because we're still seeing so many titles, you know, up and coming.
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting time for small publishers. And there's, you know, there's so many amazing, interesting, creative, engaging, smaller magazines. They're the ones that I'm most interested in at the moment. For Gym Class, getting those type of amazing people in, I think because Gym Class is, you know, it comes from a place of love, not from a place of commerce. You know, I get those amazing people coming, you know, getting involved because they just know that, you know, the motivation for gym class is one that they can relate to. So yeah, I think it's a really exciting time for magazines. But you know, you'll agree, I'm sure, that the smaller ones are the ones maybe to keep your eye on.
Yeah, well, and I think that's also what is exciting about the state of the market right now, because I think you've had this surge, or you're having a surge, of all of these, you know, smaller titles, you know, smaller print runs, but incredibly well produced, good journalism, great photography, but also very high production values. And I think many people are saying, you know, a title like yours, Johanna, as well, I think, you know, puts pressure on other magazines to simply up their game. When I say other magazines, meaning, you know, the traditional glossies, you know, that, you know, many of which we know and some we still love as well. For you, Johanna, biannual, is that a stepping stone, do you think? I mean, on one side, you know, because oftentimes you go from, you know, twice yearly, you end up quarterly, you end up bi-monthly. How do you see the market and your positioning then with this frequency?
I mean, we get a lot of readers that wish that we came out more frequently than twice a year because they do really enjoy the read and they would like to have more of it. However, from my point of view, setting up a biannual, I'm quite set in my ways. I want to keep it a biannual. I rather make it even more well-produced, you know, bigger content, more pages, magazine, and make it, you know, even more special those two times a year that we want to come out. And then the rest of the time, we like to focus on the event side of things. We do salons, for example, where we interact with our readership, but also the people that we write about on a monthly or every 2 month basis, primarily in London, but also around the world, whenever we feel that's necessary. We obviously also have a website, designyourdaily.com, which updates people daily with news from design, architecture and fashion, where we really try to take a kind of newspaper spin on the whole thing. So I definitely don't have any intentions to come out more frequently than we currently do. I can't really see any reason for it. I mean, there might be special editions or something like that related to specific events, but certainly as a magazine, I do want to keep it biannual. For me, that's quite important.
I mean, Stephen, we've seen so many titles. Now, you've got zines, which of course have trade fairs and also, you know, smaller titles, you know, banding together to get people to, you know, collect, trade, you know, introduce people to, of course, you know, new things that are out there, and we've got a couple of ideas up our own sleeve in that area as well. Do you think the sense of liveness is really important now as well, that you know maybe before, yeah, a magazine would drop through your letterbox and it came through a traditional channel. You went to a slightly removed newsagent to buy it. But do you see publishers wanting to be closer to the reader than they were before?
Yeah, definitely. You know, again, talking about smaller publishers, you know, there are launch parties and there are, you know, regular events. You know, Jeremy Leslie from Mag Culture will quite often, you know, he runs Printout, and yeah, you'll get small publishers involved in that. So there is this real buzz and this community with small publishers who they're just so happy to share their knowledge and to learn from each other, and it's lovely. There's not that competitive nature as much that you'll get maybe with the big glossies on the newsstand. So it's really nice.
Do you think it's possible to go to a good launch party for a website? I'm just wondering. Do you remember a great launch party for a website versus a launch for a magazine? Because I always wonder what goes in the goodie bag. That's the problem, right?
I personally haven't been to any launch parties for a website, but I'm sure there are some out there.
Okay. I've yet to hear of one. And if you hear one, please tell me. Johanna, I'm really interested in the balance or the metabolism that exists, you know, doing Designyour Daily and then also what you hold back on and what you say. And, you know, and let's be honest, I mean, you know, doing something every 6 months, it's a long time for things to either sit in the fridge or thaw out and then, of course, come to life on page. So what is the editorial metabolism, you know, look like, you know, structuring, you know, daily versus twice a year?
Well, we try to keep them separate. I mean, in terms of covering things every day, it doesn't mean if it's appeared on the website, it doesn't mean that it can't appear in the magazine. So we don't try to sort of feature things exclusively in the magazine or hold things back if we feel that we want to publish them quicker online. Again, I think it's what I mentioned before. We rather take another spin on it or add a different angle to it in order to include it in the magazine. You know, so for example, we did something on the Valentino exhibition, which was showing at Somerset House, which was quite a straight opinion piece, which we featured in the Decennio, on Decennio Daily. But in here, we commissioned a really exclusive shoot by the photographer Richard Horton, who took details of these beautiful couture samples, which really no other magazine had thought of doing. They were in the exhibition and they appeared a bit dowdy and weren't so well lit. And we were actually able to offer a platform in the magazine to show those couture samples that really would probably weren't really noticed by as many people in the exhibition as they would be by people now looking at it in the magazine. So I guess we try to just give it a different treatment when we include it in the magazine than when we decide to write about it online. Not holding anything back or putting it in the freezer or slowly letting it thaw. But, you know, we have a kind of engaging conversation about everything that goes into the magazine. And it grows. It grows over the 6 months. Maybe it starts out as something different than what it in the end comes out as in the printed product.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Berlay, Stephen Greger of Gym Class Magazine, Johanna Agerman-Ross of Desenia. We're going away for a short break right now. When we come back, though, we should do what this program advertises on its packaging, which is getting into The Stack. Lots of magazines to look at. Stay with us, back in a moment. Now, as I said, there is, I think, quite a few things to get through. I have, I've got, you know, a rather, well, there's a let's say, a mid-sized high-rise beside me of magazines, which I would love to talk about. I can see over there, and I think you've given me a perfect, I think, probably entree, Stephen, to talk about things today. You've got a copy of New York's spring fashion issue in front of you. And New York was a title which we spoke a lot about this week on Monocle 24 because after Hurricane Sandy cover won an ASME, American Society of Magazine Editors Award this week for the best cover in the United States. And I think everyone was just, you know, amazed by this image of a blacked out lower Manhattan and this sort of uncover cover because it was so stark and really on one side a little bit depressing and not commercial at all, but absolutely summed up everything that happened you know, with that natural disaster. So you have a frothier cover there from New York Magazine. Why did you bring it in and maybe tell us about your relationship with the New York the magazine as opposed to the city, because that could rather be probably a long conversation.
Well, New York Magazine feels like a no-brainer for me to bring in as a designer. I mean, it's one of those magazines that, you know, most magazine offices that I go into, there'll be copies of it lying around. And it's one of those magazines that the words people love and the design people love. So, yeah, it was a real no-brainer for me. It's one of those magazines that I really wish that we had in London. I wish there was a London equivalent. But at the same time, there is enough in New York for people who don't live in the city to enjoy as well. So maybe we don't need a London edition. You know, maybe New York is international and it's enough. That cover that you were talking about, what I love about that cover so much, obviously the photo is amazing. But what I love about that is its content. It's content that won that award. I mean, that photograph and the story of that photograph is just so amazing.
Well, that's what's interesting, and you're absolutely right. It's a topic which has come up, well, not just on this program, but you know, other places where there's a print cultural media intersection on Monocle 24, and many people talk about the state of London and covering London journalistically, and you know, now with a free Evening Standard, you know, maybe that does it up to a point, but then also with a free timeout as well, is it doing? But I think what you're cutting to right now is maybe, you know, is there really the deep journalism that you get, not just from New York, but also the way the New Yorker as well is able to really mine New York's cultural landscape. And you know, I would argue that there is a glaring gap in the city.
Yeah, I think about it a lot, and I wonder if there is, one, the money to be able to afford the resources that would be required to put together such a magazine. And also, I wonder, are there enough interesting people? You know, is there enough going on here?
The switchboard's going to light up in a second as well, now that you're saying that. I think there, I mean, my view, I think in London, you know, absolutely. I think if you look at, you know, whether it's, you know, I mean, Johanna, you know, covering the design community as well, probably as much as, you know, as we all are here. And then I think from, you know, I think everything that, of course, feeds the publishing industry and entrepreneurs and everything, I think definitely. In a way, it'd be great if someone really sort of threw down the gauntlet and said, you know, that, you know, the city actually needs this. It'd be very interesting to. And I think even from a funding point of view, I think if you had a really good publisher out there behind it, I think you could do it.
Yeah.
And I don't think it would be a challenge to, because I think you're absolutely right. It is about filling the gap sometimes between this, very sort of, you know, light journalism and an obsession, I think, in this town with still with too much celebrity and maybe a handful of 25 people. And I think what New York does, and, you know, and I do wonder if, you know, it's that role of the national newspapers in this country to then also cover London, but then also cover the world, which is a very different thing from what New York does. It has to just focus on, you know, the confines of those boroughs.
Yeah. But see, I think
can you pass that copy across to me?
Yeah.
Can I just add, as the design and architecture geek that I am, that cover you were talking about is actually by a quite famous architecture photographer called Iwan Baan. Mm. And I think that was quite nice that, New York would actually feature and work together with an architecture photographer, and that it sort of showed that architecture photography can actually reach the mainstream in that sense. And it was taken from a very architectural point of view, which is why it maybe looked so different as well from many other covers of that magazine.
Sorry, go ahead, Stephen.
That photographer has also done some amazing photos of the High Line in New York as well, which,
for sure.
Yeah, a fantastic photographer.
Yeah, he travels the world. He does some really good work.
And what a great story, you know, sending him up in a helicopter and, you know, fantastic.
Yeah.
I think when you look at, and I'm just looking at the spring fashion issue, which this came out at the back end of February. The other thing you're reminded of, though, when you look at, and this is maybe something you don't see so much, with titles here, is there's an interesting relationship between, of course, you know, big glossy international advertisers. Then you have, and I'm doing the business model in my head as I go through this right now. And then you have, you know, a lot of, you know, local advertisers. So you just have your department stores, etc. So, you know, much more sort of, you know, national brands. And then there's, you know, there's still a lot of fractional advertising in the title, you know, as well. I mean, it's amazing that you can get a magazine and, you know, here, snoring is dangerous to your relationship. It isn't sexy and it's ruining your love life. And you can have a quarter page, you know, ad for Dr. Farhad Hakimi and how to go and sort your snoring issues out as well, which is, again, you probably, I think the way a lot of publishers think today, you know, these would jar. You wouldn't go and set up a business plan thinking that we're going to go to Dr. Farhad and get a couple grand from him as well. But I think that's also what's wonderful, is it really transports you to New York at the same time.
I think with any sort of London-based magazine that has tried to do something similar to New York, is there's an over-reliance on, they really rely on real estate advertising.
Right.
Obviously, it's not a great time for real estate advertising, perhaps.
No, well, I mean, yeah, but you know, there's always parts of the city that are bulletproof. But you're right. I think it is. I think to build a model where you're just sort of looking at that is probably a little bit limited. You had another copy under there, so I'll let you sort of start off if you want to stick with the New Yorker, or do you want to go to something else that you brought in today as well?
I've also brought in a magazine actually that doesn't exist anymore. Mm. It ended in October last year, and it's called Eureka. And it was a monthly science supplement with the Times newspaper. And it was really, really unique in this country, at least, to have a monthly supplement that wasn't about fashion or, food. So it was really, I think, quite brave of them to do. And it folded, it closed at the end of last year. And, you know, the economic climate was given as the reason.
And it stood out for you for its daringness. I mean, for, you know, and I think, you know, looking at it from a design point of view, the, you know, to think that this was something which came, you know, with the Times, you know, as a supplement for a national newspaper, you know, I think quite well done. So was it that sense of the unexpected that appealed, or was it also just the subject matter at the same time that stood out for you?
Yeah, well, I'm not the type of person who would normally pick up a science magazine, but what they did was they made complex issues easy to understand and really simple issues complex.
Things like Attenborough and other big beasts. I'm sure this appealed to you, sort of the bear cover.
Yeah, that's pride of place on the coffee table. I own that one. But you know, as a designer, this is another magazine that local designers used to talk very highly of. Mm. And you know, they did it on not very much money. They did it on about three grand a month was their budget.
Which is, you know, let's talk about keeping it tight. I mean, that's really, you know, quite remarkable.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. So, you know, you can't produce a magazine of this quality with so little money without there being love there. Mm. No. So I think that's what I'm drawn to.
Mm. I brought one, which it's and it's timely because next week the Stack is going to be coming from Istanbul. We're very much looking forward to broadcasting next week from high above the twinkling Bosporus. But I brought in Cornucopia, and it's a title which comes up from time to time, but is something which is so dependable, and its celebration of the Ottoman world. It always sort of, you know, just immediately sort of, you know, transports you to the sounds and the smells, the tastes of Istanbul or Bodrum. Or wherever you may go, and you know, there's always these wonderful you know, reportages which might be, you know, diving into the archives to find, you know, just, you know, great paintings, and then really sort of taking you out on the wide open road. And I just thought about this when you talked about, you know, New York as a magazine as well, that Cornucopia, you know, as a title too, which is, you know, so, you know, special and peculiar to that part of the world. And in a way you think, oh, could someone else, you know, replicate this? You know, could there be, you know, the version for Norway? Or could you have a similar title which only did the state of Victoria? But there is something about sort of the richness and the depth of history and just, you know, of course, the collision of Asia and Europe, which I think just makes it an amazing magazine. I don't know if you sort of thoughts or reflections as you...
Well, you know, you mentioned Norway. I'm a massive Norway fan. So if there was a Norway equivalent, I would sign up, you know, without a moment's hesitation.
Well, there's another publishing opportunity. I mean, you know, we've just heard Anne-Marie Gardner saying, you know, about Modern Farmer, that she was happy to and thrilled to be able to edit her magazine out of Hudson, New York. So, you know, maybe you could sort of pitch up in Stefanger or Bergen or somewhere and do the same if you wanted to.
I would love that. I could do like a boat magazine and just travel. I could steal Boat Magazine's thunder and travel around.
Well, exactly.
But there was a Swedish magazine called Stockholm New,
yeah,
which was very much, I guess, you know, a bit of a more contemporary take on this. Mm. And then you also have Dansk magazine, right?
Yeah,
which tries to, but it's maybe slightly sort of more trend led.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Stockholm New, they have a book coming out, which is quite incredible for a title which existed for quite a confined period of time. But what I like about Cornucopia as well, there's no fashion in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no advertisers from any of the big, let's say, predictable brands, and I think that's what's great about publishing, you know, this type of publishing, that it really, you know, transports you to somewhere differently, that you don't have, let's say, the familiar punctuation marks that really mark a magazine today, which a lot of it is, let's say, you know, commercial or even the design style of the moment. I mean, this doesn't change, which is, I think there's a wonderful sort of sense of branding as well, that, you know, they just sort of, you know, every time it comes out, you know exactly how it's going to be pitched in a way.
But then Turkey is obviously on a sort of financial high as well at the moment.
Absolutely.
So, unlike a lot of the rest of Europe.
Exactly. And it's in no small part why we're going to be broadcasting from there next week. And also just to hear the stories of newspapers where circulation's going up. They're actually buying more paper, and these are fascinating stories when you're in these emerging economies. We're going to go away for a very short commercial break right here on the topic of commerce, of course. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're back in a moment.
Istanbul is at the crossroads of Europe and Asia, and Monocle 24 is heading there for two very special shows. On Tuesday, May 7 and Wednesday, May 8, we'll be broadcasting live from the rooftop of the George Hotel in the company of some of Turkey's most influential leaders. Mark your calendars and tune into The Globalist on May 7 and May 8. That's at 8 a.m. Istanbul time, 6 a.m. here in London, and 1400 hours in Tokyo. The Globalist, live from Istanbul, in association with GE.
If you're looking for a present for a loved one, something for the home, or some luggage to take on the road, why not visit one of our shops? Our beautifully appointed shops in London, New York, Toronto, Hong Kong, and Tokyo sell a selection of the fruits of our collaborations with a number of our favourite brands, including Porter, Hackett, Ettinger, Barena, and many others too. Plus, we can also help out filling in any gaps in your collection of back issues. So why not visit any of our shops today? You're guaranteed a very warm welcome.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, almost at the end of the program, in fact. We're talking to Stephen Gregor, founder of Gym Class Magazine, and Johanna Agumin-Ross, founder and editor-in-chief of Desenio Magazine. You've got probably three titles, but we only have about 6 minutes to go here. So maybe I'm going to pick the first title for you. And it's interesting from a literary point of view. You brought in Filter Magazine from Sweden, which I don't read Swedish. I can sort of stumble through with my bad German kind of get the sense of things, but I always pick it up when I'm at Arlanda. And two things for people who aren't familiar with Filter: where does it sit on the Swedish newsstand? What type of role do you think it fills from a publishing point of view?
I mean, I think it fills. I'm not getting the words, but a kind of general interest title, you know, that basically, I mean, the sort of tagline is a magazine for reading, for the curious. So it's definitely for people who are looking for information, but it can be anything from a really in-depth interview with a TV personality in Sweden to some big scandal that's happened. The issue before this was a really big piece on children's homes and how badly children in children's homes were treated in Sweden in the 1960s and 70s. This is actually about a mysterious series of deaths of a special bird in southern Sweden. You know, so it sort of really covers a very broad aspect of Swedish culture.
Is it always that domestic, or can it be international as well?
It tends to be very domestic, actually. And the reason why I read it, I actually subscribe to it, and my dear brother has given me a subscription for my birthday. It's really to stay a bit connected with my motherland. So it does tend to focus on Swedish issues primarily. I don't really know what it would translate to in this country.
I think it actually it fills a really interesting gap. And I think, as much as, you know, Stephen, as you were talking about, you know, maybe why isn't there a version of New York in this magazine? I'm sure lots of other people are probably asking the same, you know, question as well. You know, why aren't there, you know, why don't they have an equivalent of New York in other capitals around the world as well? I feel when you look at Filter, you know, just you know, photographically, but your stories probably run to a good, you know, 3,000-4,000 words. I mean, they really go in it for the long haul. It, you know, and it's got a, I mean, to me, it's a little bit like an updated Reader's Digest. I mean that in a very polite way. I mean, obviously the topics deal with are a little bit more pointed, but I think this is the type of magazine I would love to take on a flight with me. It's something that you would love to, as you're saying, just to, it would sort of, you know, gently land, you know, on your bedside table every month, and fills that type of role.
It comes out 6 times a year at the moment, I think. So I think in terms of the way it looks, for me, it doesn't sort of, you know, shake me very much. So for me, I do read it for the content and look at it for the content rather than images or layout, to be absolutely honest. The other magazine that I brought along was Jocks and Nerds. It's a kind of rude self-promotion as well. Desenio Magazine and Jocks and Nerds are currently joining forces. And Jocks and Nerds, to me, is a really, really interesting magazine, which has been out for the same amount of time as Disenio. And it's a magazine for men's style. The tagline is Style, History, Culture. And for me, what really stands out, and obviously I've followed it from the start. It's actually published by my husband.
Nothing like a bit of nepotism.
No, but I do have a lot of respect for it. There's some really amazing shoot in it, and some really, really great photography. All of it is specifically commissioned for the magazine. It doesn't feature a single press shot, and from my point of view, I think that's something really unique and special. And it's free, and it comes out quarterly.
It's free.
It's free.
And let's go. I don't know if we can get through that business model in the next 45 seconds. How do they manage that?
Advertising.
Right.
Yeah. And it's super targeted. It goes into menswear stores where people who buy men's clothes go. So, you know, as a business model, I think it's quite simple.
I love it. I'm a big fan. And the title is brilliant. I love it.
Me too. So we just moved into an office together, so that's why I wanted to bring that along.
I think we can unpack all of this we always sort of said that, you know, we should maybe sort of do a masterclass of this program about, you know, setting up and establishing, you know, new business models. As interesting as, you know, you heard Anne-Marie Gardner saying that they're going into, you know, community, distribution channels to get their magazine out there. You know, you can of course, you know, share office space, you know, with your partner, which is great, and of course, you know, Stephen, as we know, other people, you know, need to, you know, be, you know, with in the environment maybe of a big media company, you know, just to sort of, you know, feed your habit as well. And I could well imagine, as you're saying, with your consumption habit of magazines, that there's probably not even enough within the walls of Condé Nast. I want to, of course, thank my guest today, Stephen Greger, founder of Gym Class Magazine, and Johanna Agerman Ross for being in. Thank you very much for that. That brings us to the end of edition 36 of the Stack. We are, of course, going to be in Istanbul next week, as I mentioned, and of course, not just with this program, but from Tuesday and also on Wednesday as well. Both me, Andrew Tuck, Sophie Grove, a whole gaggle of Monocle editors are going to be there for 2 days. I'm going to be, of course, with this program next week and then on the road again. You can listen again via monocle.com or iTunes, but for now, for me, Tyler Blay, it's goodbye. Have a very good weekend. News is up next, and of course, at midday, it is The Review.